JW Mobile.
NUE Mobile.
How are things going?
I figured I'd drop out and give me a little bit of lunch today and get about my business, I guess. But other than that, things are going pretty good, I guess. Still a little tired from the weekend. Over.
They eat, right? Gotta keep fuel in the body to keep going. Yeah, I like that place we visited up there. I was thinking about asking Amy if she wanted to stay at that Pisgah Inn one weekend.
Just saw that. We didn't even know it was up there. And we're gonna go up there the next couple of weeks and stay. They've got a pretty decent restaurant. You serve three meals a day, and it's $180 a night.
On the phone, we were looking over that, and he said he saw one for $145. I didn't continue looking after that. So. But still, 180 is not bad for a weekend. That's a nice little weekend getaway, and it's not really that far.
So as far as the lunch goes, she's got me on a diet. I'm a little grumpy, but I gotta do it.
I've never really had to stick to a diet. I'm afraid once I go to the doctor 10th the next month, he's going to tell me I got to change my ways when it comes to eating, and I am not going to want to hear that. I've never had to make adjustments for my eating, but I guess as you get older, you can never say never again.
Today, we're being a little bit more selective about just the fast stuff. You know, that's my weakness. I don't care much for dessert or sweet things. But it's that savory that, you know, gets me. So we had baked chicken and broccoli and some cabbage last night. So, it's
good with cheese on it. And cabbage is good when it's made right. So, yeah, I used to like to eat cabbage. Haven't had that in a long time. And I eat broccoli regularly. I just like it. But probably isn't as good for you when they got the cheese on it. You sound like you're getting near the fringes of the umbrella of the repeater. Are you, am I scratchy on you?
A bit of scratch, but I should be able to get a little more distance here.
Better there. I guess you're getting into that range where you're hill-popping. When you were at the valley, it wasn't good, but if you came up on a hill, that was a little bit better. But did she put cheese on your broccoli?
No cheese, just straight up broccoli. I don't even know what to say about that, really.
Hey, when I was getting my full-scale pilot's license, the flight surgeon, he told me, you're a little bit dehydrated. He said, do you drink milk? And I said, yeah, and ice cream and stuff like that. I said, yeah. And he says, well, you know, milk and dairy products and all that, that's for cats. That's not for humans. That's for cats and babies, is what he said. Don't be doing that anymore. But I like cheese. I like Swiss cheese. I like American cheese. I like that kind of stuff. So that's going to – but – and he told me, don't drink anything dark, like tea or Coke or coffee or stuff like that. So – he liked cutting out all the good things in life, and I just ignored him, went on, and lived my whole life, and that didn't harm me doing those things until now. And now things start changing. My father-in-law always says, growing up or getting old isn't for sissies.
You know, I'm learning, I turned 50 in January, and I'm learning that there's nothing you can do about it, really. I mean, I guess exercise and diet, I guess. But nothing fun that you can do about it, but it's time. I got to do something.
You know, everything in moderation, one step at a time. I can handle the exercise. I don't know. I can handle the exercise now. Maybe I'll be able to handle the change in diet later.
I think she's wanting to put a treadmill or something in the house. So I'll go dig it out tomorrow and my dad's got one. He can start using it anymore, so we're gonna utilize it. But baby steps. It's all about baby steps.
She's had a lot of health equipment like that over the years, and a lot of it was thrown out or given away to other family members. But she had an elliptical. It was a really nice elliptical. I'd never been on it, but once when I put it together just to see if it worked. And it's probably 10 years old or better now. And so I chose that one. She chose the pedal-a-thon bicycle, the one that you, it's got a monitor in front of it, and you've got a coach that's driving you. And you got other people that are friends with you that make the same ride that you're making. I don't know if you heard of that one. But that one's kind of popular. She's got that one, and then I did the elliptical. Because the elliptical, you're not pounding your joints together, right? Everything's kind of smooth. Like on a bicycle, it's kind of hard on your joints. If you're running out on the street, that's really hard for your joints because you're just pounding. The ground doesn't give at all. So I figured I'd take the elliptical instead of hauling it off to the junkyard, and she can have the bicycle.
Well, Dave, I'm fixing to destinate here, so I'm gonna say 73, I'll talk at you in a little while. This is KO4NUE. I'm clear.
All right, catch you later. KO4NUE, W4DJW Mobile. JW Mobile. You having a good day, Patrick?
Dave, how about yourself?
Hey. Sunshine, rays of sunshine just beaming down all over the earth.
For sure. It's beautiful out here today.
Loving it. Those buds are coming out bigger than ever. They'll be full leaves before long.
Here, we're about 3 to 4 weeks behind y'all at the house. To dodge the patrol cars.
Of course now, along with the motorcycle guys, they're on motorcycles too. So be careful. Just, if you drive the speed limit, you don't have to worry about them.
About them, but they're obviously after somebody because they're all over the place right now over here off of Cedar Lane Road.
Every now and then they have this thing where they all get together and they concentrate on an area, and that kind of settles that area down for a while, you know?
The flashy lights on and in a hurry. Yes, sir. They're making their line to go somewhere now.
It might be happening.
You didn't go flying this weekend.
This weekend? Is that what you said?
To sync up with the repeater. Now, I said, I assume you did not go flying.
W4DJW, no. And I went soaring up there on the Blue Ridge Parkway looking for a place to launch airplanes off the side of the mountain. There are some beautiful mountains up there, some great places to fly. I don't know if they'll inhibit, you can't fly at parks, but flying off the edge of the Blue Ridge Parkway with a slope soar, y'all see those birds up there doing it. They're slope soaring like you'll be standing there at the edge of one of the slopes, and all of a sudden this bird with a 4-foot wingspan comes flying right up by your head. It's pretty cool.
I live right there at the foot of those mountains.
I used to live as close as you do to that. I'd be up there throwing airplanes off the cliffs all day, every day.
A lot of traffic in there, so I'm sure somebody's trying it.
Yeah, I saw a bunch of fishermen out in the streams, a bunch of people on the sliding rock, a bunch of lookers at Looking Glass Falls. I mean, that's a popular place to be.
Summertime, you ain't seen nothing yet. That's the reason I don't go in the forest anymore.
I figured when I went up there, it would be like a barren wasteland. I had no idea people were still attracted to that.
Sitting there at the red light where you went by the Pizza Hut to go into the Pisgah National Forest there, that'll be an hour and a half, 2 hour wait to get out.
To get out of the forest or to get into the forest?
Possibly both, but usually out.
But full tank gas when you go in there, because those hills can use up some gas.
That's the reason I don't even go in there anymore. I bet I haven't been in the forest in the last 20 years because of it.
This is besides the forest to access the parkway, though, right?
If you come up through Brevard or Pisgah Forest there, you went in the main entrance on that end. But there are plenty of other entrances if you know where they're at.
I'll look for it if I go up there in the summer when it's really popular in Pisgah, because I wouldn't want to sit there for an hour and a half. I'm just a passer through. I'm not a consumer of the fun to be had up there on that in that forest.
Well, you have to wait to get out of there some days. It's just unbelievable the amount of traffic that comes through there.
Slope soar airplane, it's made for high wind conditions on the edge of a cliff where the air hits the cliff and goes up. And you throw it down through that air that's coming up. And it goes down and it picks up speed, and you go out to one side and you turn around and you come back. And as you're coming back, you're holding down elevator in it because the wind is trying to take it up. And you've built up a lot of speed. They'll go by you 100 miles an hour. They don't even have a motor on them at all. No engine or motor or anything. They just have ballast weight in the front. And you throw it off the edge of that cliff and you just start flying it back and forth. Those are the airplanes that you have to have wind to fly in. You can't fly them on a calm day.
You have to let me know when you're going to do that. I'd like to go watch.
There's on YouTube that show people doing, it's called slope soaring. But there's a lot of competition in slope soaring too. Plus, some of the guys that are doing it now, they've switched instead of being up at the top of the mountain and throwing it off the side. They get on the side of the mountain and they fly it up and down the mountain. And those are the ones that are setting new records for speed. Some of them you'll see them trying to set a new record and their airplane will just explode. It just comes apart in a million pieces. Those are the ones that are still learning. The other ones can do between 500 and 600 miles an hour and no motor or no engine or anything, going between 500 and 600 miles an hour up and down that mountain.
Unbelievable. They're going that fast with just that.
A mountain and descend the whole mountain in less than a second. That's just amazing. If you had a camera on there and you could see that going from the bottom of the mountain to the top of the mountain in a second, and then from the top of the mountain, and that's not lapse time photography, that's real time photography. Those are just amazing airplanes.
Dave, now I'm sure you come up with a camera system to put on there to watch that, as inventive as you are.
Soar anymore. I busted mine. I had a Freedom slope soar one time, but you got to be really fussy about how you build those things. They're very precise. And if you don't, you get one of those where the thing just comes apart in the air into a million pieces.
Here's all your control system and all that you had invested in it.
That's not the receiver's like $40 and the servos are like $100 pop. Those are the most expensive. So, yeah, that's less than $1,000 in it, but the hours that you spend on the A-frame, or airframe, getting it straight, it's got Kevlar and carbon fiber, Kevlar, and fiberglass, and there's multiple layers of each, and a foam core that you put Kevlar on, where you put fiber and carbon spars in them, then you put Kevlar on top of that and you get all the air bubbles out, and that has to dry and harden. You sand all that, and then you have to put the fiberglass on. That has to dry and harden. And then you sand all of that. And then the control surfaces are just paper thin, but they got to be rigid. They can't be flexible. And it's hard. I don't know. It's like getting a piece of paper to be so stiff, it's like metal. And that's hard to do. But it's got to be lightweight and really, really stiff like that.
And 42C.
I imagine so, Dave. And like I said, that's so unbelievable they're going that fast up and down the mountain like that with no propulsion system.
Hey, Patrick. Hope you guys are doing well. Yeah, slope charge stuff today, that's kind of extreme. those things are just, those things are, it's not like any glider, normal glider that I've ever used or flown. Those things are more, they're designed more like a jet. The surfaces are so thin on them. But those guys are serious about it though. But yeah, that's a whole nother deal in building one though.
I've arrived at my next destination, so I'm gonna hop out of here for now and say 73C. Have a good afternoon, KO4 HKX, and I'll be clear on your finals.
Talking to you. Be careful out there. Good to hear from you. Go ahead, Jerry.
Take care, young man. You have a good afternoon. Sure is nice outside today. Dave, I'm surprised you're not doing any flying today. I don't see any winds outside to mount anything here.
Well, I haven't had my eye on it. I'm keeping my eye on it heavily, watching it. I watch through the woods now. If I see the trees in the wood, the tree leaves in the woods moving around a lot, then it takes some wind to get down that low. If I go up with a multi-rotor, when that's happening, it starts tilting really, really hard to stay in the same position. And I know that's just too windy for something that's not like a slope soar.
I don't think, it's been years since I've watched any of those things, but they're, it seems like about every two or three years they just go, all the RC stuff just gets more and more advanced, and it's just amazing. It gets more and more expensive too, as a rule, but it's just, technology, it's the aeronautical stuff just keeps advancing, and it always filters down to the hobby level. Boy, that's probably far above the average hobbyist level, though. I remember doing some slope swarm, but it was just smaller gliders, basically. We might get up maybe a couple hundred feet or something like that and fling them off the side of wouldn't really be a mount, but, just outcropping or something like that. And, if they had the wind up, they go down, they just pop right back up again.
Yeah, they usually start with radio control planes, and then they make their way to the full-scale planes. Like, I remember seeing the Pitt Special, the Christian Eagles, the full-scale ones, flying a lot, and then people with models of those flying. And then I remember at one point they started hanging the models on the prop, hovering the airplane, having the airplane so it would hover, hang them on the prop, and got really, really good at it. And then you start seeing the full-scale guys do that. And then I remember seeing a Pitt Special. The first one I ever saw was a Pitt Special that did that. He did a climb out, and then he went full throttle, and he held it right there for a few seconds, and then he backed it down into the smoke cloud that he was creating, and it disappeared in its own smoke cloud. So you see people learning how to do it on the models, and then you see the full-scale guys. Now they're doing that with jets. I saw somebody with one of the Russian Sukhoi jets, and they were hovering a jet. That's pretty cool. But it only starts with the models, and then it progresses to the full-scale guys.
We're about killing somebody with a model unless you hit them with it either. One of the guys I worked with had a Pitts. I don't know if he had an S1 or S2, but he had a Pitts, and I never... he'd fly over every once in a while, and I'd see him. He's pretty good. I think he was... I don't know if it was down to 500 feet or what it was, but he had progressed pretty well. He'd been flying for quite a few years, I think, though. But I heard you guys talking about that carbon cub the other day, and I'd read about those things some years ago. That's a pretty cool airplane.
Called it a carbon cub, but I guess when I really started thinking about it, I saw somebody brought a model of a carbon cub out to the airfield, and that's when I really, it first hit me, why they call this a carbon cub, and that's because it's so, they put so many G-forces on it, they have to reinforce the spar with carbon fiber, or else the thing will break.
I saw where some game and fish commission of something out west can't remember where it was now. It was one of the western states, Montana, Wyoming, someplace, had bought some of those as their planes, you know, their normal planes to use for instead of buying a regular plane. You know, they bought the carbon cuts and had bought five or six of them, I think. They were really, really happy with them. They are cool looking planes, so it's hard to beat a Cub.
It is. They're kind of short coupled. I think they make an STOL airplane that's in kit form. That's not a Cub, and it does a little bit better than a Cub, and its tail is a little bit longer than a Cub tail. And those are the ones that will take off in 3 feet and land without doing a rollout at all. When they land, the wheels don't roll. It just touches on the ground and it's done. That is really neat. That's taking a Cub to the extreme, way beyond a Super Cub.
Yeah. One of the guys used to have a sporting show when TBS first got started. He was in North Carolina. His name was Frank White. He had a mob or something like that he used to fly in. It was zebra striped. It was a real distinctive looking plane. I think he lived in Snow Hill, North Carolina, somewhere like that. But I met him at some sportsman shows over the years. He was a really nice guy. I think they build those things somewhere. They used to build those things somewhere in Georgia, maybe Tifton or somewhere like that. I'm not sure exactly where now. But the Super Cubs are pretty nice. They just don't fly very fast. They're slow. And I imagine that carbon cub is a lot better. You know, it's stiff enough. Instead of having it stiff enough where it can withstand some G-forces and winds and that sort of thing that the regular Cub couldn't. I don't know what they put in them now. I don't know what kind of engine. Did you notice what type of engine they were putting in the carbon cubs?
I'm not aware of any increase in horsepower or decrease in the thickness of the wing, the cord thickness. But I imagine they've done some changes there. You know, it's either, you know, a thick cord and extremely aerobatic, or a thin cord and a whole lot faster.
Professor Status and Tybrid, and he'd take us up in it every once in a while. Back in the early 70s, that was a lot of fun. He'd been a fighter pilot. I got on what service he was with. He was actually South Korean, but I don't know what. He trained with the Air Force and a couple other here in the States and trained in Korea too, but he was a really good pilot. He scared me a few times though, but I just wasn't accustomed to my line of flight. I'd done at that point in time, it'd been mostly on the level. I hadn't done any loops and any other stuff. That Stoppy was a really, really nice airplane.
He took on some LT-11 Bird Dog. They were nothing more than a Super Cub that was painted olive drab and it had some munitions on it. But they used those for reconnaissance, behind enemy lines reconnaissance. I think it was called an LT-11 Bird Dog, but I'm not the 111 is the stealth fighter, and I think the 11 is the is the Bird Dog. Have you heard of that one?
Or 19, as a matter of fact, another guy that I worked for, he was plant manager at Springs, and he was in the Army. That's what he did. He flew the Bird Dogs and did reconnaissance in the Mekong Delta and all over the place. And he was a really nice guy. But I had no idea he was a Vietnam vet at the time. This had been 40 years ago, I guess, Dave. But I saw where he passed away not long ago, but I never knew he'd flown those planes, but he sure had. He did at least a tour or two. I think he lived in Charleston. He's just a real heck of a nice guy. He was like one of the big wheels at Cannon Mills at one time as well, but he was just, it is surprising when I saw it, but I think he won a couple of Bronze Stars, but I never knew about it. I just knew about his service, but I didn't know what he did. It was really surprising. I'd love to ask him a bunch of questions about what he did then.
The plane my dad was on when he was in the Army, he was the radio man. So he would let out 300 feet of strut long wire on HF frequencies over Korea, and he would send Morse code out the back end of an LT-11, or nine, maybe it wasn't 19, I don't remember, for some reason it's in my head as 11, but he would send that out, and he was a pilot too, but he didn't do the pilot part for the Army, he did the radio man position for the Army, and so he was sitting behind the pilot in a Super Cub called an LT-19, but he'd fly out over the Pacific Ocean. And one time he was telling me about when he was out there, they had a cork for the fuel gauge. There was a piece of wire that had a bend in the top of it and had a cork on the bottom of it. And that was down in the gas tank. And when that bend in the wire got down far enough, you know you were running out of gas. That's because the float was floating on top of the gasoline. And he said he kept an eye on that. He was out over the Pacific Ocean. He kept an eye on that, and he was just having a good old time because, you know, with a Super Cub, you can do loops and rolls and things like that you couldn't do with a regular Cub. And so he was out there over the ocean doing that and noticed it was time to come in because he was getting low on gas, and he couldn't remember how to get back to the station. He had to fly along the beach and was running out of gas. And he said he finally did make it back, but it was a guess. It could have gone either way. He said that's the scariest he had ever been in an airplane.
Awesome story. I love to hear stuff like that because there's so many things that happened, and a lot of those guys just aren't around anymore, and they just don't. You don't hear those stories as much as most of those guys that love planes would like to hear. But Tracy was just he was a. I mean, he was one of these guys that was real. He was just, I mean, you knew when you were around him, you know, they knew what he had all kinds of confidence. But I'd love to hear some of the stories, because I know good well that if he was flying over to Mekong, there were people shooting at him all the time, I guess. That's one of the things that I remember a guy that used to, when I was going to national race, one of the guys that was one of the Goodyear blimp pilots, told me, he said, I get shot at all the time. He said, I get over Tennessee and Kentucky. He said, people think we're spying on. He said, I got all kinds of holes in the airframe. I said, oh my God, that's crazy. He said, yeah. He said, it happens. He said, we try to get them high enough where they can't reach us. He said, we'll sit down someplace and we'll see them be pulling holes in the airframe.
Well, that's exactly the same. That's what happened to my dad. The airplane went down and behind enemy lines, and he survived it. He had to destroy all his equipment, and walking out, he got shrapnel in his back, and he landed at that O-Team VA hospital for months and months and months on end. I got pictures of him where they had a little triangle thing hanging over his bed. And to do pull-ups, he was laying in the bed. He had a scar from the center of his chest to the center of his back, and it went down and around his waist and up there back the other side, where they had to just lay him open and pick pieces of metal out of his side, out of his chest cavity. And he had to stay in there for months, and his pull-ups, he would pull on that little triangle-shaped bar. They looked like those things they used to stick a bar in and go around in circles to ring it to tell you it's dinner time. It looked like one of those things. But it was hanging above his bed, and he'd do pull-ups like that to build his strength back in his stomach after going through all of that. But anyway, that was the end of his days in the Army.
Fortunately, they were shot down, but it was fortunate he survived it. Hopefully, it didn't have any lasting effects from those injuries, because that was just... I mean, there's nothing protecting those things. I don't guess it's not like a Huey or something like that. We did have a little bit of armor on the bottom of them, but because those planes were light. I mean, they're light. There's not much room for air on them when you're in a Super Cub as far as weight. And I remember one time they carried munitions. Did they do that during Korea too?
You mean like? Added protection to the bottom of the airplane? Is that what you're talking about?
Yeah, I was wondering if they had any protections about them. I know it was they used in Vietnam. I don't know what they did or not. I don't remember reading or hearing about that. But, yeah, they fly so slow. They're prime targets if they know where you are.
I think their goal was to not be seen, because they flew at night, and there's no lights or anything on, you know, when they were flying. He wouldn't tell me and my sister about what happened. I mean, he told me about his flight out over the Pacific Ocean and getting lost and hunting up and down the beach line for his base. It wasn't like there was no satellites or anything like that back then, right? It wasn't just like plug in some coordinates and hit the go home button. But he told my mother about what happened, and my mother wouldn't say anything to my sister and me at all while he was alive. He wouldn't say anything to us about, you know, the details of what happened over in Korea. But he told her, and then after he passed away, she told us.
I think that's the way most people who saw who were in combat are. They don't talk about it. Generally, as a rule, they don't. But that's still an incredible story. And I mean, that's just, it's just so many people involved in those things over the years. As I said, it's like this guy that I worked for him for probably 8 or 10 years and never, like I said, I knew he was a Vietnam veteran, but that's it. I never heard another word about any of this stuff until I found out from a mutual friend when they had his funeral a few years ago about, you know, what all he, you know, from one of his family members, what all he'd done, and I just had no idea. I would never thought this guy was, yeah, he's just such a, he was always a calm guy and had a lot of confidence, but he never spoke a word about it as far as I know, not to any of the people that he worked with.
I think you're right. That's a general rule. Well, I got a telephone call coming in. Jerry, let me pick up that telephone call, and I might be back in just a minute. W4DJW.
N4DJC, clear. Good talking to you, Dave. Yeah, I am.
T4PFI, I just moved the radio out of the house and put it down here in my shop. I had an extra one, and I guess you're the first one I've talked on to see if the antenna's working right. It's been up for a long time, the antenna has, but the radio, I just brought it down here.
To me, the audio's great. There's not a bit of noise anywhere.
Okay, it's one of them little small ICOMs. I think it's a V8. 8,000 or something like that. It's been sitting up there in the shack for I don't know how long. I hadn't even had it plugged up. I decided I've got a little shop down here, and I came down and I put it down here so I could talk a little bit on it. I appreciate you letting me know it's working.
V300H that I bought several years ago, they were on sale, and now those, I tell you, all the radios have gone up so much. It's an ICOM. Mine's about 65, I think it's either 50 or 65 watt. It has a heat sink, but doesn't have a fan on it. But I get it out and use it every once in a while. But I generally don't have to run that much power. But, you know, it sounds perfect to me. You couldn't ask for a better signal.
Well, that's great. I know the antenna's not corroded up there. And it's been up there with nothing hooked to it for, I know, 2 or 3 years. I didn't even bring my SWR meter down here to see if I had anything going on. I just plugged the thing up, so I guess it's still working okay. You know, you sound like somebody that I used to talk to. I don't want to insult you, but your voice, at certain pitches of your voice, sounds like Ray Allison.
Nah, I tell you what, it's very possible. I sound like a lot of people. I've got trouble in my throat, but well, again, my guy across the street from me is from New York, and he said, "You sound like my wife's neighbor's from Kentucky." And I said, "Yeah, I've had people tell me I sound like somebody from Kentucky or West Virginia." And I said, "But I'm from Georgia. I'm a Georgia native." But a lot of people tell me I don't sound like I'm from this area. I'm from somewhere else. And whatever I'm talking, I said, "Man, I said I sound like a hillbilly, but I guess I get by anyway." Don.
Ray Allison.
I know the name, but I don't remember. I don't remember him. No.
He was the net manager for our club. Of course, he passed away here a while back, It's a fine gentleman. I've been to his house a number of times. He's brought him and his wife came down to visit us, and I kind of miss him. I sure do. At W4DJW, I've talked to him a number of times, too. He kind of took over part of, I think, what Ray was doing. And, but anyway, were you ever in the service? I heard y'all talking about airplanes.
Where's that little boy at?
No, I wasn't. I missed out on it. I went through the lottery, but I didn't. I graduated in 69 and went through the lottery. And I just left, even though I was going to school, I just left my status as 1A and took my chances. And it turned out okay for me, I guess. It didn't turn out okay for a lot of other folks, but I didn't feel right taking a deferment at that time.
I was a jet engine mechanic. I worked on the old B-52 and worked on the U-2 one time. With a bunch of guards standing around with rifles. That was back when that thing was super, super secret. But I think everybody knows it's not anymore because they've got other things that's flying up there now.
B-2s or something else. And a B-52, one of the guys I've been around a lot of military people throughout my life, my son and all my uncles and my dad and cousins and everybody else. And I was always interested in my father-in-law was in the Air Force in Korea, but during the Korean War. But another guy I worked with, he was in the Air Force. He made a career out of it, I guess. Don, he was in there for 20-something years, I guess, and he was stationed somewhere out near Kansas, Salinas, or somewhere out there. And he was on a flight crew of a B-52, and he. He had all kinds of tales to tell me about sort of stuff. I don't think any of his flights. I think he was flying out of the U.S. He wasn't flying out of European theater or any place like that, on the West Coast. But he had a lot of good tales to tell about B-52s, about those wings moving around, flapping around, and just those things. He said they were like trains flying in the sky.
That chicken when they're sitting there full of fuel on the flight line, the wings all droop down, but when they get in the air, they are a beautiful airplane. But I worked on those, worked on the U-2, worked on the B-47, which is now not even flying anymore. But the U-2 had the same, one of the engines, it only had one engine, but it was more or less a glider with an engine. It had the same engine in it that the B-52 used, the J-57 Pratt & Whitney.
That's interesting. You know, that's something I didn't know. I've read a lot about him. Read about Gary Powers, all the stuff that, he did. And I always found it interesting that the U-2s were, they were still flying those things. They may be still flying them now. Yeah, they flew those things for years. Of course, since you worked on it, they flew those things for years after Blackbird and some of these other ones were up in the air. Because they were just, those were amazing airplanes. So both of them, both the 52 and the U-2, had a, you were talking about flying, doing the 47s. Yeah, that was
I was thinking about the P-47
Thunderbolt,
is
what I was thinking about.
Oh, yeah. Okay, that's a different thing altogether. U-2 plane, the outrigger wheels, which is under the wing on each side, when they take off, they fall off.
That's interesting. I've always seen them with that. I've never seen one in flight that I recall. I've seen the SR-71, and my first cousin flew a B-58 Hustler, and I've seen him. I think he was flying. I don't know where he's flying. He flew out of Florida for some reason every once in a while. This is back in the late 50s, I guess, early 60s. That was an interesting plane, too. I enjoyed, him telling. Of course, it's been years later after all the classified stuff was made public. He told me some interesting stories about speed records and stuff they said in that B-58. But the U-2's always been a... Tell you what, that thing was that was eyes and ears for many, many years. flying for decades, I guess, and they just didn't, I don't think people realize how often they were flying and how far they were flying.
58 Hustler was, I never worked on one, but I did see one that came to our base. I was stationed in Abilene, Texas, Dice Air Force Base. It was a SAC base. And he landed there, I guess, to refuel or whatever. And when he took off, you're talking about loud. He had a stream coming out the exhaust tailpipe on that thing. It looked like a pencil point. Looked like it maybe 15, 20 feet out the back of it. And it just rattled your eardrums.
See, I don't know what kind of engine they had in those things. I just remember him telling me years later, after he probably retired 20 or 30 years before he started telling us about some of this. He said, yeah, that thing, he said, you know, we didn't always care, but he said, every once in a while, you know, they put a live one in there with them. And, you know, that was always, that always made me feel unusually. Yeah, I said, that would frighten me to know that kind of, they did that a lot, but he said, they never told anybody about what all they did or what they were carrying, but he said, that was an extremely fast plane. I don't think, I think the speed records, you know, that plane stood for years after they, before something like the SR-71 or some other, you know, faster plane beat him. That was basically a rocket with wings.
PFI for ID. Yeah, those things had a delta wing on them. It didn't have a regular, you know, it looked like a triangle or what, in a way.
They were pretty good looking planes. I never heard about. Actually, I've seen them in flight. I've never been near one where they landed or took off. I imagine they, of course, the guys that piloted those things, you know, they like to show off a little bit anyway, I guess. Because that thing was pretty fast. I can't remember what it was. I mean, I can't remember what the record was, but it was, you know, it stood for quite a few years before faster planes, you know, could beat it, because that was a general, it doesn't seem like there were a whole lot of them in service either, Don. Does that sound right to you?
Yeah, they didn't last a long time. They had I believe it was in Dallas or Fort Worth, there was a base up there that had a squadron of them, but they didn't stay around too awfully long. I think they had some problems with them, but one of the problems they had was going too fast. I heard this story, I don't know if it's true or not, but one of them was coming in and he hadn't let his landing gear down yet, but he was going too fast. When he let him down, it blew one of his wheel well doors loose, because he was going too fast when he let his gear down.
Too good to me. That sounds like that's a recipe for disaster. But we've had some interesting planes over the years, and jets especially. The new ones, I like some of those old ones, those Super Sabres and some of the other stuff too. When you said B-47, I bet you said B-47. I said, you know, I remember they were still flying those in Vietnam, I think, those old Thunderbolts.
Yeah, I think they were, because I was in the service from 1959 to 1963, so I guess you can tell by my voice and by that I ain't no young chicken no more.
Sorry. I find out that every day. I just turned 71 a few weeks ago. Every joint in my body, it aches every once in a while. When they don't ache, I think something's wrong with it. But I remember they had those. I think they ran Sky Raiders and P-47s and lots of stuff in Vietnam. I think whether the U.S. did or whether the Vietnamese flew them, but it seems like Vietnamese might have had several. But I remember several guys telling about those things. Those things they could carry so much munitions with them. He said they were like, it wasn't as elegant as the A-10 Warthog was. They said they could carry stuff and take hits, and some of the other stuff they'd be gone, they'd be blown out of the sky. But they had enough armor and enough munitions on board those prop planes, so they could do some real damage.
Sure could. I also worked a little bit on the old C-130. They're still flying that thing. They come over our house every once in a while from out at Donaldson Center. And but I didn't like working on a turboprop engine. There was a lot of things on there that you couldn't get to them without using a mirror. And you couldn't get your hand in there. Whoever designed some of them things, they just didn't think about the poor mechanic that had to work on them.
These cars, you can't get to anything. You have to take something major off to fix something minor. They had those C-130s. I tell you what, they've done a lot of work over the years. And I know my dad, when he was stationed in Burma in India, the C-47 did the same thing for them. They said they carried everything. When they would, of course, he was in the Army, though, but they had, I guess it was on, it would have been called Army Air Corps then, I guess, but he said they said those guys, those pilots fly those C-47s over the hump, and he said they were glad to see them landing with supplies, because everything to Overland would travel by train, and he worked with a railway battalion. He said, you know, the trains in India, he said they didn't have a schedule, they just got there whenever they got there, and they tried to modernize them, and they said the tracks were in terrible condition, and you know, back then that's when Stillwell was building that Lido Road, and he said they just had all kinds of problems during the monsoon season to get the supplies to the engineers and the guys who were building the road and having to protect them on top of that. But I think they ran some kind of narrow gauge in India. He told me what it was, but I've forgotten now. But it wasn't a 4'8" like the standard gauge we run here in the United States.
Well, I got to get out of here. My wife just hollered at me. I guess she got something she wants me to do. I'm the only slave on the plantation here, so I guess I better get up and go see what she wants. I enjoyed talking to you. I hope the rest of your day goes well, and maybe things will be better for you tomorrow. This is KG4PFI. The name's Don, and I'll be 73s, and we'll catch you later.
Good afternoon. I know all about the boss stuff. Been retired now about 8 or 9 years, and I thought when I was retired I wouldn't have to do more, but it seems like I get more things. It seems like I don't have as much time as I used to have when I work for a living. Talk to you later. Have a great day. Talk to you later. N4DJC, 73.
Around KAQAXQ will be QS flight at 60 mile 1.